Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Peter Kahn, the Athenaeum's director. I'm very pleased to see so many members here. I'm equally pleased to see so many not members here, prospective members of the Athenaeum. Today, as you know, and that's why you're here, it's going to be Circe. I'm going to make a couple of the usual introductory remarks. First of all, would you please silence any phones or other devices you may have that could interrupt the speaker or your neighbors. Secondly, after the discussion is over, there will be a reception and book signing in the adjacent room. Now, before introducing our speaker, I'm going to present her with the award which she has come to Philadelphia to accept. And if she would join me for just a moment, and then she'll have to sit down again, because then I'm going to introduce her. Madeline Miller, we're delighted to present you the annual Athenaeum Literary Award for this extraordinary novel, Circe. Join me in congratulating. A well-earned award. Madeline Miller has been reading, writing, and teaching the classics for decades. And out of that immersion in this extraordinarily rich and important body of literature have emerged two remarkable novels. Tonight we're going to be privileged to hear more about the second of those novels and the Athenaeum's literary award-winning novel, Circe. Join me in welcoming Madeline Miller.
Hello, can everyone hear me? Okay. I'm an old high school teacher, so I have to come out. I can't be behind the podium, it freaks me out. So what I'm going to do today is talk a little bit, is read actually a very short passage and talk a little bit about how I came to write the novel and then take questions. But before I do any of that, I just want to say thank you so much to the Philadelphia Athenaeum for that award. It was an honor, and it's an honor to be here today. When I was in high school, I actually lived one block away from the Athenaeum, and I would pass it every day on the way to and from school. And I would always look at it as a classicist. I would look at it and I would think, there must be amazing secrets in there. I really want to go in. But I didn't even know I could go in, and now here I am in with all of you. So thank you. Thank you for coming. So, Circe in mythology is the daughter of the sun god Helios. She is a nymph and also the first witch in Western literature. And she's most famous for appearing in Homer's Odyssey and turning Odysseus's men into pigs. So the passage that I'm going to read to you comes from towards the middle of the novel, after she has already started this turning men to pigs. And the he in the passage is Odysseus. He asked me once, "Why pigs?" We were seated before my hearth in our usual chairs. He liked the one draped in cowhide with silver inlaid in its carvings. Sometimes he would rub the scrolling absently beneath his thumb. "Why not?" I said. He gave me a bare smile. "I mean it. I would like to know." I knew he meant it. He was not a pious man, but the seeking out of things hidden. This was his highest worship. There were answers in me. I felt them buried deep as last year's bulbs growing fat. Their roots tangled with those moments I had spent against the wall when my lions were gone and my spells shut up inside me. After I changed a crew, I would watch them, scrabbling and crying in the sty, falling over each other, stupid with their horror. They hated it all, their newly voluptuous flesh, their delicate split trotters, their swollen bellies dragging in the earth's muck. It was a humiliation, a debasement. They were sick with longing for their hands, those appendages men use to mitigate the world. "Come," I would say to them, "it's not that bad. You should appreciate a pig's advantages. Mud slick and swift, they are hard to catch. Low to the ground, they cannot easily be knocked over. They are not like dogs. They do not need your love. They can thrive anywhere, on anything, scraps and trash. They look witless and dull, which lulls their enemies, but they are clever. They will remember your face." They never listened. The truth is, men make terrible pigs. So my relationship to these myths goes back into my childhood. My mother used to read me the myths from, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey and other Greek mythologies, and I just absolutely fell in love. And I can still remember how the first line of the Iliad kind of reverberated in my brain, "Sing, goddess, of the destructive rage of Achilles." And just how powerful. Immediately I heard that, I thought, who is this Achilles? Why is he so angry? I feel I need to clarify that I also really liked Dr. Seuss and the Runaway Bunny, but this was sort of what grabbed me. And so as soon as I could read for myself, I started reading all the Greek myths I could. At the time, I lived in New York City, so we had access to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which has an absolutely incredible antiquities collection. And I would just go and stare up at these statues. There was one in particular that I can remember just looking at over and over, which was this wounded Amazon. And it's an incredibly dramatic pose. So, you know, she's bare-breasted and she's sort of an arm up and you can see the wound in her side. But it would have been even more dramatic in the ancient world, because although we think of all these statues as being very austere and very pale, actually they were all painted bright, bright colors. So there would have been just a gash of red going down her side. It would have been really intense to see it. And it's a really hard thing to actually make that, to sort of see them that way. So if you're interested in that, you can look online, and a bunch of people have done kind of reconstructions of what the Parthenon would have looked like, not pale at all, a riot of color. So it's really interesting to think that sort of our interpretation of their sensibility is actually just because all the paint has worn off. So once I got to high school, I moved here, and I had a wonderful Latin teacher who saw my obsession with these stories and with Homer in particular, and said, "I can have you reading Homer in about a year if you're willing to work hard." And I said, "Sign me up." And so I was able to start reading the Iliad with him in about a year, and reading the Iliad in the original was a revelation for me. I thought that I had loved these stories in translation, but in the original Homer, sort of reading these words that were so old and that just had this incredible poetry to them and this incredible power to them, it was life-changing. And so when I went off to college, I knew that I wanted to continue to study Latin and Greek. Now, my relationship to Circe, in particular, started when I was about 13. I was in my English class, and everybody in English class in that school where I was, it was actually not here, it was still in New York, read the Odyssey. And I was thrilled, because this was the first time I had my own copy of a translation of the Odyssey, and so I was highlighting, and I was writing in the margins, and I actually found this copy the other day, and it's really embarrassing what my notes were. So that will never see the light of day, but I was so excited. And I was particularly excited about the Circe episode, because if you know Greek mythology, you know that the female characters are often very flat and two-dimensional. In fact, sometimes they're literally just names. It's this person's mother, and this person's daughter, and this person's sister, and if their story is really super exciting, they might get to die in it. And that's pretty much it. There are a couple of these larger figures like Clytemnestra, Medea, sometimes Antigone gets put in that category, but they're often quite villainous in their portraits, and they usually have to be punished for whatever power they have by the end of their story. But Cersei is a little bit different. She does wield this enormous amount of power, but she is not punished for it by the end of her story. So I was very interested in sort of seeing what is this intriguing female character that somehow has kind of gotten around this flattening that happens. And I was also excited about that episode in the Odyssey because it's a really interesting moment in Odysseus's own story. If any of you know the Odyssey, you might know this background, but I'm going to kind of give a little bit of background, which is that Odysseus is the prince of Ithaca. And when Helen of Troy runs away with, slash is kidnapped by, depending on what you're reading, to Troy, then all the Greek kings and princes and captains get together and they all set sail for Troy to try and take Helen back, but also to take the city of Troy, which was the richest city, and controlled all the trading routes into and out of the Black Sea. So there was definitely an ulterior motive there if this whole war happened. And so they spend 10 years besieging the city of Troy, and they can't take it. And finally, in the last year of the war, Odysseus comes up with this idea of the Trojan horse. He builds a gigantic wooden horse hollow inside. They stuff it with Greek soldiers. The rest of the Greeks who don't fit in sail away just out of sight, pretending that they've left. And the Trojans, through one trick or another, end up pulling it inside the city and having a huge celebration. Hooray, the Greeks are gone. After they've all gone to sleep, the Greeks come out, they open the gates of the city, the rest of the Greeks come in, and the city is sacked. Now, sacks of cities in the ancient world were ugly and horrifying things. Everything that could have been taken would have been taken. Everything else would have been burned. All the men would have been killed, and the women taken as slaves, the women and children taken as slaves. And so that's what happened to Troy, and all the Greek kings and princes now with their, you know, holds stuffed full of Trojan gold and Trojan treasure and Trojan slaves would have then sailed off as conquerors. 2 years after that, they've all made it home, with the exception of Odysseus, who in that time from leaving Troy as a victorious conqueror, the man who thought of the plan that conquered Troy, he has lost 11 of his 12 ships, all the stuff that was on them. He's seen his men torn apart by the Cyclops, eaten by cannibals, just brutality after loss after brutality. And then here he is kind of washed up on this lush and beautiful island. He's broken, he's grieving, he's in despair. There's a god who has a vendetta against him, and then sort of enter Cersei to this equation. So when they land on this island, Odysseus immediately goes to explore, and he sees a little smoke drifting above the trees, so they know someone lives there. And what Odysseus says is, we need to go find out who this is. Maybe they can help us. Maybe we can take stuff from them. If you've read the Odyssey, you know Odysseus is basically a glorified pirate. The reason he gets into trouble with the Cyclops in the first place is that it's his idea to go check out the cave. And then he sees the cave, and his men are all kind of like, you know, everything here is really big. I think maybe we should leave. And Odysseus says, no, we're going to get a really good gift if we stay here. So they stay, and you know, the Cyclops comes and eats a bunch of them. And so at that moment, it's sort of an interesting thing whenever he lands, because what's he going to do? Is he going to ask for help, or is he going to take what he wants? So he sends this group of men up without sort of specifying, and they come to this beautiful, luxurious home. And out in front of the home, there are tame lions and wolves just kind of hanging out, lolling around. The men are a little disturbed by this, but they continue on to the front door, and they're greeted by a beautiful goddess who says, come in and let me give you food, let me give you wine. Turns out she has drugged the wine, and as soon as they consume it, she casts her magical spell, turns them into pigs, and drives them out to her sty. One of the men has held back, knowing that perhaps the lions and wolves tipped him off, and he goes to tell Odysseus what's happened, you know, there's a witch who's turned them all to pigs, and so Odysseus has to go confront her. And on his way up to confront the witch Circe, he's stopped by Hermes, who's the great god of travelers, the trickster god, who actually is an ancestor of Odysseus's, and you can see that they kind of have that wily, tricky, sneaky blood that they share. And what Hermes says to Odysseus is, this witch Circe is quite powerful, so I'm going to give you this herb that will make you immune to her spells. So armed with this, Odysseus goes to confront Circe. And this is sort of the moment that, as a 13-year-old, I was really excited about. Because I thought, this is going to be a great scene. There's going to be like a battle of wits. There's going to be banter. She's smart and complicated. He's smart and complicated. You know, how is this all going to play out? It's going to be great. But what actually happens in the scene is that she gives him the drugged wine. She tries to turn him into a pig. It doesn't work. And then he pulls his sword on her and threatens her. And she screams and falls to her knees and begs for mercy and invites him into her bed, basically in one speech. And I was really mad, actually. You know, and particularly this sort of idea of, here's this interesting female character, and she has to be literally put on her knees in front of the hero. You know, the phallic sword did not escape my notice. I felt like, here we are, can't we just stay with this female character just a little bit longer? Can't we just allow her to have a little bit more space, a little bit more agency? But, you know, no, epic is a very male, traditionally male-dominated genre. Odysseus is the hero, so she's the obstacle, so he has to overcome her. Now, I didn't know that feeling of anger would eventually lead to this novel, but I do think that was kind of the beginning. Then I ended up encountering Circe many times later as a graduate student in classics and as an undergraduate as well, because it turned out that I wanted to specialize in ancient epic poetry. So as an older student, when I came to Circe, I actually saw something completely different, which is that I think Circe has gotten a very unfairly bad reputation in sort of literary history after Homer. That in general, when people remember her, they remember the pigs. And she's often portrayed as kind of a man-hater, sort of like a spider at the center of the web, the, you know, false seductress, oh, you can't trust women, sort of that type of character. And in fact, in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, oftentimes in those pamphlets about how to control your wife, Circe was the illustration for, this is what happens if you don't listen to us. You're going to get turned into a pig. So I sort of thought, well, but you know, that's really not the Circe that Homer gives us. In the Odyssey, after that moment where she kneels to him, they do in fact become lovers. She stands back up and she says to him, I see that you and your men are grieving and exhausted. Stay on my island and heal as long as you need to. And he takes her up on it. He and his men stay on the island of Aiaia for the next year. And at the end of that year, Odysseus actually doesn't want to go. Circe's island is the only place in the Odyssey. Odysseus is constantly agitating to get to Ithaca, to go, we have to get to the next place. Circe's island is the only place that he does not want to leave. His men have to come to him and say, remember Ithaca, Penelope, we should get going. And he says, yes, you're right. And he goes to Circe and he says, okay, I'm ready to leave. And I think this is another sort of moment where people sometimes confuse her with Calypso, who is the other nymph in the Odyssey on an island who also has an affair with Odysseus, so I understand, and their names both begin with C, so the confusion makes sense. But Calypso is the one who holds Odysseus prisoner for 7 years against his will. But Circe, when Odysseus says, I'm ready to go, says, great, here's what you need to know. You have to go call a dead prophet out of the underworld. So here's the dimensions of the pit you have to dig. Here are the sacrificial animals. Here are the rites you have to perform. She gives him absolutely everything, this incredibly specific knowledge that you basically couldn't get except from a witch who had a necromancer brother. So she ends up being incredibly important to him, and after he goes and does this quest about talking to this dead prophet, he then has to leave and get past all these monsters, the sirens with their enchanting song that makes men mad, Scylla and Charybdis, and she also gives him excellent advice about how to get past those. She's the one who says, put beeswax in your men's ears so that they don't hear the siren song, and then they can sail safely past without crashing their ship on the rocks. And she actually goes a step further. She says, but you, Odysseus, tie yourself to the mast. and leave your ears free, and then you will be able to be the only man alive who has heard the siren song and lived. And that really struck me as I was reading the Odyssey, because what it told me is that she really understands Odysseus. That is exactly the type of person he is. He's the great storyteller of ancient literature. He's going to dine out on, "I'm the only man who's ever heard the siren song," for like the next 30 years. And she sort of gives that to him, you know, his insatiable curiosity, his love of a good story, and she gives that to him as kind of a gift. So that was very interesting, because it implied to me that not only was she incredibly helpful to him in the whole second half of this episode, but that she really had insight into his character. So part of what I wanted to do in writing this novel is kind of go back to that original Homeric vision of her. You know, yes, she's scary and she can turn men into pigs, but she's also benevolent and healing and incredibly knowledgeable about kind of the monsters of the world. So I wanted to bring that aspect back in. I also kind of felt that Homer was inviting me to tell the story from Circe's perspective. Now, most of the Odyssey is narrated by, you know, the poet, whoever he may be, or she. But the rest of the time, it's Odysseus telling the story. And the Circe episode is actually one of those sections that Odysseus is telling. And he's telling it to the Phaeacians to sort of, you know, get them on board with hosting him and make a good impression. And when you realize that, suddenly that whole Circe episode starts to feel really different when you realize that it's Odysseus the great liar telling it. Suddenly it starts to seem really self-serving. You know, oh, there was this terrifying witch, but I totally tamed her, and then she threw herself at me, and she was super hot. And that's kind of what Odysseus says over and over in the episode. He talks about how beautiful Circe is, Circe of the beautiful braids, as if kind of Circe just wears prom hair all the time, hanging out on an island, waiting for people to show up. And, you know, all those things that he's saying about her, all those ways he's describing her, they make him look good. That's who they're really intending to make look good. And so I kind of felt like, well, not only are we sort of dealing with this genre of epic that naturally kind of puts women to the side, actually Odysseus himself is shaping this story. So I felt like, well, it's only fair for Circe to get to give her version of how that might have gone, which might look very different. One of the other things that I always do when I'm kind of thinking about a character like this as I go through and I try and find all kinds of little bits, not only in Homer but elsewhere, and sort of see what my imagination seizes upon. One of the things that's really exciting going from being a classicist academic to being a novelist is that I don't have to take all the bits. I can just take the ones that I want, the ones that I like. There's a whole story about Circe turning a guy into a woodpecker that I was like, that's just not speaking to me. So I left that out. And as a novelist, I have the freedom to do that. And so I sort of submerge myself in all these descriptions of Circe, all these different versions, and I kind of let things sprout and germinate. And one of the things that ended up germinating the most was this kind of throwaway description of her from Homer, where Homer describes her as the dread goddess who speaks like a human. And that word, speaks like a human, it's just one word in the Greek, audeessa, is really mysterious. It's kind of, does it mean speaks human languages, or her voice sounds like a human? It's been debated among scholars what it means. It's also applied to Achilles' talking horses, which doesn't really clear up the issue. But that really grabbed me. What does it mean to be a goddess who speaks like a human? You know, to me that immediately implied this is a character with a foot in both worlds. This is a character who doesn't really belong in the world of the gods. And in the world of the gods, which is obsessed with power and strength, this person would probably be an outcast. But they also wouldn't really fit into the human world. And so that sort of one word in the Greek ended up eventually, for those of you who've read it, you know, informing kind of the arc of the entire novel. There were other little bits that I took from various other places. And one of them that I want to talk about comes from Ovid. So Ovid has a scene with Circe. He has a couple different episodes with Circe because he is the great poet of the metamorphoses, the transformations. And Circe herself is, of course, a goddess of transformation, so he has to get her in. The story he tells about her is about Circe and Glaucus, this god who used to be mortal, and a nymph whose name I won't say because it is a spoiler. But it is a 3,000-year-old story, so I don't know if that counts. And this nymph. And Circe falls in love with Glaucus and does something horrible to the nymph. And in Ovid, her portraits and her kind of psychological reason for doing that is very thin. It's kind of like, well, you know, women, they do stuff like that all the time when they get angry. So he doesn't really go into giving her reasons. And I really wanted to kind of transform that and give her more reasons, but also make her live with what she's done. What does it mean to have to live with having turned someone into a monster? But in the context of telling that, Ovid has this one little thing that he says, where he says that Circe had an ingenium, a temperament, more fitted for love than other gods. And he is implying romantic love. That's what Ovid means. But again, as a novelist, I have the freedom to take that however I want. And the way it resonated with me is as something like empathy. Because I think that for me, although I don't think Ovid was meaning to allude to Homer, those two details, the goddess who speaks like a human and the goddess with the more of a temperament for love, those two things felt like the same thing to me. Because humanity's greatest gift is really empathy. And empathy is the great work of literature. And when we read, that's really what we're doing. We're stepping into someone else's life. And so what would it mean to be a goddess who was born with the capacity for empathy? If you know the Greek gods, you know that most of them were not empathetic. In fact, they were horrendous. They were petty and violent and angry and self-absorbed, and if you made them angry, they would step on you and your children and your children's children, and, you know, they're sort of, the rage just went on and on. And when, you know, Achilles is at his most violent in the Iliad, he's acting like a god. So the gods are not really paragons. They are, you know, today we would call them basically sociopathic narcissists. So that's Circe's family. And she has to, you know, so what would it be like to be born into this family, but able to feel empathy, but looking at this sort of horror show around you? One of the things that I have always loved about Homer and the myths in general is how incredibly human the stories feel to me. That even though there are six-headed monsters and prophecies and gods, that at their core, they boil down to really human experiences and human emotions. You know, the Odyssey is really the story of an exhausted war veteran who's desperate to get home to his family. And then once he gets home, sort of the struggle to reintegrate into his life there. I think that's a story we're still telling today. Same thing with Achilles. You know, Achilles has had this horrible choice given to him before he heads off to the Trojan War. Achilles is the best warrior of the Greeks before he dies, and then Odysseus becomes the best warrior. But Achilles is given this choice as a teenager, where his mother says to him, here's what the fates have laid out for you. You can live a long and happy life, and no one will ever remember your name, or you can die young and be famous forever. And I think being a teenager and getting that choice is a particularly terrible time to get that choice. And Achilles chooses to die young and be famous forever. So when he heads off to the Trojan War, he knows he's not coming home. He knows that whatever glory he can scrabble out from the Trojan War, that's what he gets. And the Iliad is really kind of the story of him living with the consequences of that choice. And his fight with Agamemnon, the Iliad kicks off with a huge fight between Agamemnon, the head of the Greek forces, and Achilles about kind of Achilles' status in the camp. And oftentimes when I read it with students, they say, oh, Achilles is very whiny. Oh, he's so annoying. Why is he getting so upset about it? Because he has literally given up everything else for his reputation. And so when Agamemnon attacks his reputation, he has no choice but to kind of hit the nuclear button. And so all that humanity, you know, these myths contain stories of grieving parents, of family dynamics, husbands and wives. There's this sort of amazing moment in the Iliad where Hector, who's the great prince of Troy, the Greeks' enemy, but in many ways the true hero of the Iliad. I think he's the most sympathetic character really in the Iliad. And his wife are there with their little son. And Hector still has his war helmet on. And his baby sees him with the war helmet on. It's this great bristling crest and starts crying hysterically. And they sort of laugh because they realize, oh, he's freaked out by the helmet. And so Hector takes it off and his son recognizes him and they have this lovely moment. Of course, it's an incredibly resonant moment because, you know, his father, the war sort of taking his father away, transforming his father. His father's going to die in the course of the Iliad. So it's very sad, but it's also just very real. And when my youngest daughter was kind of 18 months, my husband put on a baseball cap for the first time around her. And she became hysterical. It was like she'd never seen him before in her life. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're in the Iliad. This is that moment. And so part of what I wanted in telling the story of Circe was I wanted to keep it really grounded in that humanity. So I see this as a novel about a woman coming of age, finding her path, finding her voice. But, you know, it's also the story of someone who's born into an absolutely terrible family and trying to get out. And what's the cost of getting out? And can you get out? So that was all something I was thinking about, is really kind of keeping that grounded in experiences that we all have. Hopefully we don't all have families like Circe. But I think that we all have the experience of, as children, we're born into a particular family, and that family is our whole world for our whole growing up. It's kind of like being born onto an island, and you take that island for your reality, and then at some point, you get on a ship, and you sail away, and you kind of look back, and you realize, huh, that looks different than I thought it looked. And, you know, you meet some other people who come from their own islands, and you start to realize, oh, that thing my family does is really strange, or that thing my family does is really lovely. But that experience of kind of separating from family and learning to see your family clearly is something that I think basically everyone goes through. So that was something I was thinking a lot about as I was writing the novel. Before I get to questions, I just want to talk briefly about witches. So one of the things that drew me to Circe's story was the sort of aspect of witchcraft. And what I loved about it is that Circe is born a goddess, but she's born like the lowest of the low, the very bottom of the goddesses. She's a nymph. And if you know Greek mythology, you know that the nymphs are the ones who are being assaulted, they're being raped, they're being handed off to men that they don't want to marry. They have no control over their own destinies, and they're generally tragic and upsetting stories. So that's what Circe is born to be. But when we see her in the Odyssey, we see her wielding all this power that she has basically invented for herself. She sort of decides, I'm not going to accept that. I'm going to literally invent witchcraft. And her witchcraft is a totally different type of power. Witchcraft comes from knowledge of herbs and spells. It comes from digging in the earth. It comes from work, which is anathema to the gods. And so that was really interesting to me, is that, again, we sort of see her dabbling between humanity and the gods, that she is reaching for this thing that's very human, which is not being able to just say Shazam and make something happen like the gods can do, but to create something out of her will and out of her knowledge. And so that was really interesting, that she was this woman who was a self-made woman. I did a lot of thinking about witches as I was kind of thinking about this and the different types of witches that show up in literature. Obviously, the one I think we're most accustomed to seeing is the hag, the kind of, you know, Macbeth, double, double, toil and trouble. They're ugly. They're making disgusting, you know, potions. They're doing evil things. But there's also a lot of other types. There's kind of the foreign witch. That's kind of the Medea category. Or you can also put Sycorax, Caliban's mother, in there. Or Tituba from The Crucible. She kind of goes in there. And the foreign witch becomes terrifying. It's sort of like, well, of course she's a terrifying witch. She's from someplace else. So it's kind of like her foreignness and her witchcraft become one frightening thing. There's the sexy witch, that's kind of Cersei's variety. And there's also the good witch. But what all these witches have in common throughout literature is really that these are women who have an amount of power that makes a society around them uncomfortable. They have an amount of power that makes people want to try and control them, but they can't really be controlled. And so that was very exciting to me to think about. And one of the things that I sort of realized is just how much currency this word still has. I hadn't really realized that. The women who are in power today are still getting called witches. If you Google pretty much any politician anywhere on the spectrum and the word witch, you will go down a horrible rabbit hole, so don't do it. But you will find all this stuff about sort of this is still how we insult women. We call them witches. So part of what I wanted to do is give a portrait of a woman, of what a witch really is, which is a woman who has an amount of power that she has given to herself as opposed to accepting kind of a place in society. I'm going to pause there. There's a lot more I could say about Greek mythology or Homer or Circe or any of these characters, but I want to see if there are any questions first. Yes. Yeah, so in Ulysses, you mean. So Circe does make a very strange appearance in Ulysses. I would never, ever presume to say why James Joyce did anything. I honestly think probably someone has written their dissertation on that, but it wasn't me. So I don't know. But I think this idea of... I feel like it lends itself. Circe is a very dramatic and exciting character, so I think she could certainly have that kind of power, although it's not clear whether or not James Joyce actually intended those scenes to actually be staged. So it's hard to know what he was doing there. But one of the things about Circe in general is how she feels very un-Greek. Actually, when you read the Odyssey, she feels like she kind of sticks out. And what scholars have speculated on is that actually the goddess Circe and the portrait of her in Homer is drawn not from Greek goddesses, but from Eastern and Anatolian goddesses. Now, we're accustomed to talking about Circe's island being in the west. That's where the Romans put it because they claimed everything, so they wanted it all to be over by where they were. But in Homer tells us that Circe's island is near the dancing grounds of Dawn, i.e. in the east. And that makes sense. Her brother is in the east, Aeetes. He's over there. And so, you know, she really comes out of this tradition more of the Potnia Theron, the mistress of the beasts, the goddess Cybele from Anatolia, who has two lions who pull her chariot. Oftentimes these goddesses are associated with birds of prey, and one translation, one sort of etymology of Circe's name is that it means hawk. And so it seems like she kind of comes out of this other place. So I don't know if he was kind of trying to, I'm going to give him all kinds of credit for this, but maybe he wanted to kind of step outside the bounds of,
I can see that.
Yeah. So, yes. Sure. So I don't know if any of you have read the recent translation. If you haven't and you have any interest in the Odyssey, I would highly, highly recommend it. I think it is a brilliant translation, and I think Emily Wilson is actually doing some similar things, although she's not writing a novel, but she is speaking back to the text and kind of correcting some things in the text that by tradition have kind of been obscured. So before I talk about her interpretation of Circe in particular, I just want to give an example of that. Because one of the things that often gets kind of glossed over in the Odyssey is that after Odysseus comes back home, he finds his house besieged by these suitors who have been trying to get Odysseus's brilliant wife, Penelope, to choose one of them. Your husband's never coming back, pick one of us. And she's been resisting and stalling, but in that time, the suitors have been really horrible, and they've plotted against Odysseus and Penelope's son, and they've consumed all of Odysseus' stores. And so Odysseus murders them all, which kind of in the world of ancient epic feels like, okay, they earned that. But then Odysseus goes on and he ends up killing all the men who helped them. And then he goes on and he orders these slave women, who are called maids in many translations, these slave women who, according to Odysseus, have had sex with the suitors, he orders them to be killed as well. And it's a moment in the Odyssey that is incredibly disturbing. Because, of course, the slave women, they would have had absolutely no choice about this. There was no consent to give, right? So he's talking about this as if they have betrayed him, but these women would not have been able to say no to the suitors. And yet Odysseus orders them killed as a sort of way of cleaning the house. And I think generations of translators have sort of started using the word maid to describe these women. Which really means something very different to our modern ears. It kind of implies someone who maybe gets paid or goes home or has some choice, as opposed to slave. And the word in Greek is slave. That's the word in Greek. And so Emily Wilson goes back to that, and she uses that, which I think is really an important correction. I think we have to sit with the disturbing thing that Odysseus does there. I think we just have to, you know, remember this was a slave society. Most of these characters were aristocrats. And I think we need to grapple with the text honestly, and so she really supports that. Her vision of Circe is a little bit, I feel like it's kind of similar in the sense that Circe is strong, but she is translating the Odyssey as opposed to transforming it, and so a lot of that kind of Odysseus's, you know, descriptions of her are definitely in there. I would not say that Homer's description of Circe is entirely positive, and I think some of that negativity comes through. So, I mean, I think Emily Wilson does a great job throughout the whole thing. So, as I said, very recommended. Yeah.
In the last year, I've been struck.
I think that's a great question. Is there really a resurgence going on of this interest in classics? And if so, why now? I have a couple different responses to that. One is that I think that we oftentimes go back to historical things, classical things, old things during times of uncertainty. And I don't know if the classics provide comfort. You know, we're not the first ones to be here, or if it's depressing. Here we are again. I don't know which one of those it is, maybe both, depending on who the person is. But I think that there's this sort of urge to look back for answers and comfort and sort of seeing how things have played out in other ways. So I think that may be kind of a piece of it. I also think that we are in an age right now where we are really welcoming new voices and other voices. And I am a firm believer in the way the novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie talks about the danger of the single story, and how if there's just one version of a story, if it's just Odysseus's version of the trip to Circe's house, then that becomes fact. Whereas we need these other versions to kind of give richness, other perspectives, and I think we're kind of embracing that right now. We're excited about other voices, and so I think that's happening, that it's natural that these are stories that many of us grew up with, and so we're returning to them, but looking at them kind of now that we've opened up to talking about these things in different ways, we're kind of looking at them. So I think that's also happening. But to some extent, I also think it's always been happening, that literally since Homer existed, since the Iliad and the Odyssey existed, those stories were being retold. And Homer himself actually comes out of oral tradition. So these were stories that were handed down, that were told by grandparents to their grandchildren. Partially it's why I always start with a reading, because I very much wanted my novel to have kind of an out loud presence, because Homer's original works would have all been performed. They would have been a bard singing them and people going to them as sort of the movies of their day, the plays of their day. And so I very much wanted Circe's voice and Circe to have that kind of presence out loud. But I think that basically, you know, this tradition is as old as the stories themselves. So you have kind of Aeschylus. That's what the great tragedians were doing, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. They were retelling stories from Homer. In fact, Aeschylus talks about how all his work is slices from the banquet of Homer. And then you have, you know, the Romans. You have Ovid, of course, telling these same stories. You have Virgil, the great original fan fictionist, you know, saying, let's tell the story of the Trojan War again, but let's take the Trojan perspective. So even in the ancient world, they were doing this. They were saying, let me think about this from another way. Let me imagine how it would look like from the other side. So I think that tradition is very old. And I think that maybe the thing that is different, and I think it's been ongoing. I mean, Shakespeare has his version. You know, Chaucer gets involved, Margaret Atwood, you know, James Joyce. We have kind of all these different people who have been retelling these stories all along. But now I think we are allowing more people to tell them and more people kind of feel ownership. And this was something I really struggled with when I started Song of Achilles is, who am I to try and retell this story? How dare I? I asked myself that a lot when I was starting Song of Achilles. You know, I don't have the right to this. And so because I was so worried about that, I actually didn't tell any of my classics peers that I was working on the novel. I kept it completely secret. And it wasn't until I literally had the finished copy of Song of Achilles in my hand that I called up my mentor. And I was like, so I've written this novel about Achilles, and I'd really like to send it to you. And he said, well, I certainly hope you made Achilles and Patroclus lovers. And I said, oh, I did. I think you're going to like the novel. So I sent it to him, and he did like it. But it was really hard for me to claim my right to do it. But I think that now people are starting to feel like these texts belong to everyone, which is right, because, as I said, they were oral tradition. They started belonging to everyone. So I'm glad that this movement is happening. I always think more voices is better. And of course, my secret Latin teacher agenda is thrilled by more classics out in the world.
Did you ever think about writing for stage?
So I'm so glad you asked me about theater, because theater is kind of the other great passion of my life. So the question was about, you know, have I thought about writing for the stage? I was a theater director for many years, and I specifically directed Shakespeare plays. And so much of what I know about storytelling and voice really came out of directing Shakespeare plays. And when I write, I want to see my character. I want to hear them as if they are an actor delivering the lines on the stage, or sometimes as if I am the actor delivering the lines on the stage, depending. And so theater is really important. And I have thought about doing a little writing. I've kind of noodled around with a play, with an Aeneid play, which may one day, I don't know if that will ever come to fruition, but it's the impulse is there. But mostly I love directing. It would have to be exactly the right thing for playwriting. With directing, that's really where my heart is. But yes, theater has been an incredibly important part of the whole journey. Oh, well, thank you. Well, speaking of theater, you guys are working together on this. So the Aeneid is out there. I would love to write about the Aeneid. I absolutely adore it. It's the other sort of great ancient love of my life. But right now I'm thinking about The Tempest, Shakespeare's Tempest, which is something that's been kind of in my mind for a really long time. So I'm The Tempest and the Aeneid, but I think The Tempest first. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. There's Shakespeare throughout my books. I can't help it. And specifically, if you read Troilus and Cressida, I have a bunch of allusions to the Odysseus portrait in Troilus and Cressida as well. Anyone else? Oh, one more. Yes. Sure. So aside from getting the opportunity to write about Circe's perspective, I was really excited that there were all these other women in the story that I was going to get to explore as well, many of which who don't have much story at all. In particular, Circe's sister, Pasiphae, who, you know, she should be the next HBO miniseries. Pasiphae is the mother of the Minotaur, so you'd have to be pretty intense to be that. And she and Circe, but there's really nothing else about her. She's married to King Minos of Crete. She's the queen of Crete. But mostly she doesn't get talked about. It just, you know, Ariadne is the focus, or the Minotaur, or Minos himself, Theseus, of course, but not her. And so I was really excited to develop this dynamic of, you know, Circe and her sister, who is also a witch, and what that means. And they take very different paths. Circe really decides that she likes being alone, and she kind of is taking the Virginia Woolf path of a room of one's own, except upgrade an island of one's own. And so she sort of decides that the best way to have independence is to be alone. But Pasiphae wants to be in the world. And so in order to be in the world and to be a woman who wields power, she decides she has to be a villain. And that's basically the only way she can get people to respect her. And part of what I wanted is for Pasiphae to start out as a very kind of villainous character, but then we start to understand that in some ways she's reacting to a lot of the same stuff Circe is. She's just doing it in a very different way. So that was important to me. Of course, Penelope shows up in the novel. Penelope, Odysseus, as I mentioned, Odysseus's brilliant wife. And that was such a treat, knowing that she was waiting in the last quarter of the novel for me, because Penelope is also one of these characters who's, we get more about her than many other women, but she's very veiled. Oftentimes she's literally veiled in the Odyssey. And we don't really see, we just see kind of little glimpses of her. And I love this idea of her and Circe as these two survivors, these two really smart women who are both artists, craftswomen, both mothers, kind of meeting and having this conversation. So that was really exciting to me. Medea shows up. She's Circe's niece. Circe's related to everybody. She's Circe's niece. I'm not going to pass up the opportunity to write about the other great witch in ancient literature. But part of what I wanted to do with Circe's journey is I wanted to have her actually struggle with a little bit of internalized misogyny. I wanted her to actually have thoughts about women that were coming from kind of the patriarchal structures around her and have to work through that a little bit, that she is so kind of traumatized by her childhood among the nymphs that she basically dismisses all nymphs as being the same. And she has to kind of come to think that, that maybe that's not true. Maybe if I'm different, maybe there are others who are different. And so I wanted that to be part of her journey, which I think is something that happens oftentimes to women, is that we do have internalized misogyny is a real thing. And I wanted her to, you know, she has some missed opportunities in her life because of that. And then she kind of has to come back around. But the last thing I'll say on sort of the great female characters that I was so excited to work with is that Penelope was really like a pillar of the novel for me. That what Circe, I wanted Circe's story to really parallel Odysseus's. So Odysseus's story is animated by the longing for nostos, for homecoming. And Circe's story is also animated by that same yearning, except she doesn't have a home. She doesn't have an Ithaca waiting for her with her family there. What she's really yearning for is a family, sort of a chosen family, a place where she can feel at home. And Penelope is a key part of that. So thank you all so much.